Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich has appointed a special investigator to look into what led to the Secretary of State's office's failure to send out publicity pamphlets early enough before last month's special election. Michael Morrissey will lead the investigation, which Brnovich says will be entirely independent of the AG's office. Joining me with more on this is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. And Howie, what do we know about Michael Morrissey, and what do we know about what he'll be looking at?
Well, he is a former Assistant U.S. Attorney, has experience prosecuting criminal cases. Now he is a defense attorney, curiously enough, on criminal cases, which suggests he knows how to dig through a file and figure out, has a crime been committed? Is there probable cause to charge someone? Obviously, we're starting from the perspective of, was a crime committed when Michelle Reagan failed to mail out about 200,000 ballot brochures ahead of the special election? Brnovich initially said he didn't think there was a crime, and if even if there is no penalty there, but he'd like an outsider to take a look. But while the investigation is seemingly is limited to the issues of what happened on ahead of the May 17th election, we also know that Morrissey has been given, if not carte blanche, at least some license to take a look around and see what else is going on.
Secretary of State Reagan's elections director compiled a lengthy report not that long ago, sort of detailing from the office's perspective what happened. And, of course, a lot of the blame, as Michelle Reagan has talked about, rested with the vendor, IBM, for not helping out compiling these lists. Is that considered a starting point in this investigation? Does that have any role to play in this investigation?
Well, I certainly think you can suggest that the vendor may bear a role, but I think the vendor is going to have something else to say. The independent consultant is going to have something else to say in terms of the responsibility to provide the right information. It's the old computer saying, garbage in, garbage out. And if the vendor was not being asked the right questions about how to compile a list, then it's not the vendor's fault. But the other half of it comes back to what I remember, being the old fart, if you will, around here, of the question of Nixon and the cover-up. It wasn't Watergate that created Nixon's problems. It was the cover-up. And the fact is that Michelle Reagan knew at least a week, if not 2 weeks, before KJZZ finally reported on the fact that, we didn't send out 200,000 brochures to homes with multiple voters, which means at least 400,000 voters. And what's important to point out is, it's 200,000 out of 1.9 million. Well, it's not really 200,000 out of 1.9 million. Maricopa and Pima counties had prepared their own mailing lists. So this had to do with the mailing list for the other 13 counties, which was 533,000 brochures. So she failed to mail 200,000 out of 533,000. That's 40% failure rate. Something went wrong there, and this can't continue to happen.
Howie, what are the possible outcomes of this investigation?
Well, theoretically, Mr. Morrissey could come back and say, look, I believe that under Title 16-352 or whatever, that the law was broken. We know the law was broken, and that criminal charges should be filed. And here's the basis of my belief that criminal charges should be filed, that this was more than negligence. More likely, what we're going to come up with is a list of recommendations of A, what he found that was wrong in terms of the office, and B, how to keep it from happening again. One of the things that we're all looking for, and a lot of us suspect, is that when Michelle came in, she got rid of a lot of people who had been there for years under Ken Bennett and under Jan Brewer before him, and put in some of her own people, and that's her right as an elected official, and patronage has its place. But if the people you put in don't understand how things were done before, that creates all sorts of problems, and that ultimately falls on her.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always.
Well, we'll be watching on August 30th and finding out how many people will be standing in line at the polls.
The Western Hemisphere's biggest men's soccer tournament kicks off today with the U.S. taking on Colombia in California. As KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports from our West Valley Bureau, Glendale is one of 10 U.S. cities hosting Copa America games for the first time in the tournament's 100-year history.
All right, y'all, turn and pass, let's go.
One of the Excel Soccer Academy's elite club teams warms up at the Phoenix Sports Center, where youth soccer's popularity has helped keep the indoor field full of players for decades. From the NBA to the Arena Football League, there's no shortage of sports in the Valley. But local organizers for the Copa America Centenario hope Metro Phoenix will soon be seen as a prime venue for the world's most popular sport. Jeff Gulner is the tournament's venue director for Phoenix and Glendale.
Does the novice or casual soccer fan understand the importance of this tournament? It might be fair to say not necessarily. Certainly, those south of here, Mexico, Central America, and South America, this is big-time soccer.
Wednesday, Ecuador will square off against Peru at University of Phoenix Stadium, and the tournament's third-place match will be on June 25th. But the Valley's marquee matchup will be Sunday, when the Mexican national team goes up against the ninth-ranked team in the world, Uruguay.
There's a gentleman named Chicharito for Mexico. What's he going to do this summer? He's playing in Copa. What's he not doing this summer? He's not playing for his Mexico national team in the Olympics.
The Mexican team has played in Glendale before, and Gulner says between local fans and those traveling north, officials do expect a sellout. How many tickets get sold for Ecuador versus Peru remains to be seen. World rankings show Peru will be a major underdog. But current rankings don't reflect history. And there's plenty between the two South American countries that share a border. Carlos Velasco was born in Ecuador, moved to Los Angeles, and settled in Phoenix. He'll be at the match with the Ecuadorian consulate.
Ecuador and Peru have had wars for land. Ever since I was a child, I always remember that we had this idea that Peruvian people were just not our friends because we were at war with them. So it was a sense of patriotism.
Velasco says relations have improved greatly, and Peruvian immigrants now make huge economic contributions in Ecuador. He says a once deadly rivalry has transformed into something more civil, soccer.
There's always this a little additional competition when it comes to winning and beating Peru.
The Phoenix restaurant El Chuyo serves authentic Peruvian cuisine, and Jose D. Ramirez is part of the family that owns and operates it. He's a jack of all trades, sometimes bartending, sometimes cooking.
Dios le preguntó a los peruanos, ¿qué quieres? ¿Comida rica o buen fútbol?
God asked a Peruvian, what do you want? Great food or good soccer? And since then, we've been eating really well. The phrase pokes fun at the fortunes of Peru's soccer team. They may struggle, but Peruvian cuisine has always been top-notch. Still, Ramirez can't wait for the match against Ecuador, and El Chuyo will have a bus to take fans and their musical instruments from the restaurant to the game.
So we're going to play music at the stadium, hope we win, we're going to pray, we're going to enjoy the game.
When Ramirez was a kid, his father took him to see the national team play in Peru. He cherishes those memories and hopes to bring more home from Glendale on Wednesday. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Businesses in the Valley are hoping to create some memories of their own from the tournament games to help figure out what the economic impact of the Copa America games might be on the area. I'm joined by Mike Sunnick, senior writer for the Phoenix Business Journal. And Mike, what are people saying about this?
Well, we have a June 5th game with Mexico and Uruguay. And when Mexico comes to town to play the national team, it does draw, you know, really good crowds. So, you know, there should be a big crowd out there. Obviously, you know, you wonder about the heat that we're going through and how that impacts people maybe spending money or spending time at Westgate or at the bars and restaurants, or, you know, certainly not going to be tailgating in the summer. But there'll certainly be a big crowd at the stadium and stuff. They're a big draw when they come here and play.
How about for some of the other teams involved in the games?
You know, Uruguay has a lot of players in Europe and some pretty top names in soccer. So you may see some soccer fans want to go see those guys play. And traditionally, Uruguay is a very small South American country. It's done really well in World Cup and you know, continental type competitions and stuff. The other game is June 8th. That's Ecuador and Peru. you know, I don't know what kind of local appeal that's going to have. Those countries aren't, you know, soccer powerhouses like Argentina and Brazil and those types. But it's a big tournament and stuff, and there's, you know, the soccer's got a pretty good following in this market, and obviously they're playing at UOP Stadium in Glendale. Interested to see, you know, big crowd for the Mexico-Uruguay game, the second game, not so sure about that. And then we get the third-place game in June 25th, the finals in New York, but then the losers of the semifinal matches will come here. Those are likely to be some pretty notable teams, so you may see a pretty good crowd for that.
Do you anticipate that the fans who go to these games will be people who live in or around the Valley? I mean, are folks traveling from Central or South America for these games?
There's some of that. I mean, with some of the bigger followings, you know, the Mexican team, Brazil, those types of teams, you do see folks travel when they come up here to play the U.S. or play exhibitions. So, you know, don't be surprised if you go to the game to see some folks from Peru or Ecuador to have traveled regionally to go see those games. The thing that kind of complicates that is the Rose Bowl in Pasadena has a bunch of games, too. And so, you know, if folks were thinking of coming from California, which has happened before when the Mexican national teams played here, people have traveled from Vegas or California, you know, to see their team play. With games in Pasadena in LA, you know, those folks may just stay home and wait to see that one. But yeah, people do travel for these things, and you know, it may not be a huge number of people from Ecuador, for example, coming here, but you will see some fans that, you know, make a vacation out of it and stuff.
Well, given the fact that, as you say, some of these countries will probably not be traveling well, as they say in the sports world, does that lessen the potential economic impact if a lot of the fans at these games are people who are already spending their money in the Phoenix area?
Yeah, I mean, you know, these are group matches. These are all like, you know, round robin preliminary group matches. So all these countries will be playing multiple games in the first rounds, and then like any other, you know, soccer running a tournament, they'll narrow it down. And so I think you probably see some people that maybe travel to another city where the weather's a little nicer or a little closer. So that is a challenge and stuff. If you look at the venues and they're playing in places like Chicago and Philadelphia and Seattle and the Bay Area, you know, big football stadiums, they've tried to spread out the kind of marquee teams, the U.S., Brazil, Mexico, where you will get big crowds. So they've tried to spread the wealth some. So I think every city's got a, you know, pretty decent couple of games they'll get, and then there may be another game that might not get quite as much and stuff. But, you know, it'd be a good test. You know, we're trying to grow ourselves as a soccer market. So when you know, if you get good crowds for these types of games, it kind of shows the league and sponsors and organizers that, hey, you know, we're a good soccer market.
Mike Sonix is a senior writer for the Phoenix Business Journal. Mike, thanks.
Hey, thanks, Mark. Appreciate you having me on.
The Tempe part of Papago Park is a popular area for people interested in hiking, jogging, or walking the dog. Homeless residents have also been comfortable in the area, and that led to complaints about garbage piling up and unpleasant odors. On Thursday, the city of Tempe took action by beginning a cleanup, with the police department, human services division, and public works division collaborating. Tempe Councilman Colby Granville is with me to talk more about the issue. Colby, this isn't necessarily a new challenge for the city. Why did additional action need to be taken?
Recently, it has gotten worse than it had been before. And so as people would stay on the designated trails, the trash and the smell of sort of someone living there started to become enough where even from the trails, you could tell from a distance. And the trash wasn't sort of staying under the tree anymore. It was getting into other parts of the park. And I'd say about 3 or 4 weeks ago, we started to get a few emails from residents, and those emails actually have escalated.
What took place earlier this week as far as cleaning things up and as far as talking to some of the homeless people?
We got our first email. It came to one of the council members, might have been myself, might have been all of us, and forwarded to staff and said, hey, you know, it seems like people are seeing something that we're not aware of. Can you go check it out? And they went and checked it out. And they came back and reported back and said, yeah, we're seeing a fair amount of stuff that we didn't know was there, that's sort of out of our normal patrol routes. But we're not going to immediately come with sort of the paddy wagon and sweep everyone up, because that's not a really humane way to deal with the issue. But frankly, it's not even a fiscally responsible way to deal with the issue, because as soon as you sort of move people along, within a week or two, they're going to move right back. And so the goal, both from a humanitarian standpoint, but also from a money standpoint, is to get people into services, whether that's mental health services, whether that's for veteran services, whether that's transitional housing. I mean, there's all sorts of options. You know, we told all the people that we bumped into, all the transient population, look, we're going to be back in a couple of weeks. We'll give you rides to these locations. We'll do whatever you need us to do. But at the end of the day, it's not your park. It's a public facility. And so if you're not going to accept these services, we are going to move you along, and we are going to come back to make sure you stay moved along.
What keeps this on the radar?
We're not going to fix this for a week, and then in 2 years when we get an email again, we're going to go back and fix it for a week. And, you know, that's not the way you run a responsible government. What we'll do is we'll say, okay, as part of our patrols, we're now going to change where we patrol. We're going to change how we patrol. And we're going to start circulating these areas on a regular basis so that this isn't something where it's just like, well, we solved the resident's problem. We fixed the email, and now let's move on until somebody emails us again. Because it's just, that's not the way you govern, you know, in a sort of equitable, responsible way.
So what about general quality of life, Colby? How does something like this affect folks who want to use the trail or affect folks who live nearby? And at the same time, you talked about humane treatment of transient population or folks who are homeless. How hard is it to find that balance, or is it not that hard?
There is a balance. I mean, one of the things that we're very cognizant of is we don't want to say, well, you can't be here, but we don't care where you go, but not here. You know, we're not going to just ship everyone to Gilbert or something like that. The thing that we want to look at is we want to treat everyone with respect. Everyone includes transient people. Everyone includes homeless people. But everyone also includes residents of Tempe. It includes people that use the trail. It includes people who don't use the trail. And so there's always this balance process that goes on of trying to make sure everyone has a place at the table and that everyone can get what they need to feel like they have the highest quality of life that they can have. Some of the things that we've realized and learned over the last 20 years is maybe short-term answers aren't great answers. One of the things that someone will say is, well, we're going to go out and we're going to do a free meal and a shower. Okay, that helps with the free meal and the shower, but the goal isn't to just help the homeless or transients. The goal is for there to not be homeless or transients. And that sometimes in the short term can be a more expensive prospect. That can be a housing first model. You know, that can be a lot of things that as we sort of have worked through it over the decades, we've understood that maybe we're spending a little more time on the front end, but we're actually solving the problem rather than band-aiding the problem.
Tempe Councilman Colby Granville. Colby, thanks.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Arizona got $25 million federal dollars in the third year of the Race to the Top education program, and a new report looks at what the state did with that cash. It's a lagging report dealing with the 2013-14 school year. Peter Lang is a senior director at the Arizona Department of Education. And Peter, first off, what do you make of the report?
Sure. Just as you mentioned, it's a lagging report. So my first impression is that we've come a long way since then. From the time period that this report is covering.
What do you think is the biggest thing that the state has done, the biggest sort of challenge that it's overcome that was identified in this report?
Well, we've had a number of challenges, but in terms of some of our successful strategies, we made tremendous strides with respect to internal and external collaboration to help us move forward. And so within the department, we made great strides to to foster greater communication between program areas, units, and divisions within the agency with respect to the work. And then we also built and have maintained great relationships with external partners in that work, some of which include, for example, our regional service centers that were created as a part of the Race to the Top process.
One of the other issues that the report mentioned was that it seemed like there was some kind of inconsistency with how some of the resources were being used and maybe how they were being made available to teachers in different parts of the state. Is that something that your agency has been trying to work on as well?
Well, I guess let me clarify, you know, a piece there. Part of our plan with these resources were to help foster the creation of high-quality instructional resources that developed by Arizona educators for Arizona educators that then went would go through a rigorous vetting process to ensure that they are of high quality and aligned to Arizona standards. And so as part of that work, one of the things that we learned is that's hard to do. And so we engaged both, again, internal collaborations and external collaborations to advance that work. But part of our thinking, and again, we're a bit beyond that now, but at the time was this notion of to go slow, to go fast. We were more concerned that the resources that would be developed as part of this process were of high quality and of good utility, rather than simply amassing large numbers of resources just to meet an arbitrary metric. And so that's where I would say within the report where they're referencing those instructional resources, that's what they're referring to.
Would you say that overall the money that Arizona has gotten from the federal government as part of Race for the Top has made a difference in the state's educational system?
I would say so. They were resources that were provided at a time when we had significant fiscal challenges as a state. And budgets for both our department and then also for our schools and districts, you know, across the state were severely impacted during that time of the Great Recession. And so when these funds became available to help support our efforts, they helped provide an opportunity for us. And this was our thinking in the design of our approach, was that how can we help to support our schools, our districts, our teachers and leaders in helping to either deepen their work, accelerate their work, or to help to enhance their work that they're already doing. So they were critical resources, I think, in a time period when we had severe fiscal challenges.
Peter Lang is Senior Director at the Arizona Department of Education. Peter, thank you.
Thank you.
The national popularity of auto racing has grown dramatically. In some places, it's considered one of the big four pro sports, along the bastion of football, baseball, basketball, and hockey. And when you get that many fans, the money also expands in a powerful way. After the recent legislative session came to a close, Governor Doug Ducey signed a bill that could provide more than $40 million to promote races at Phoenix International Raceway over the course of 30 years. To learn more about whether this kind of financial horsepower is becoming more common, I'm joined by Dustin Long, who covers NASCAR and auto racing for NBC Sports. Dustin, are you seeing more of this across the country? And if so, what's the logic behind it?
Well, the racing community certainly has tried to get public money in the past. And obviously, you look at other sports teams, and obviously, as you've seen in Phoenix, the public money that's gone to the sports teams and sports arenas there and elsewhere throughout the country. But you know, one of the challenges for racing venues in the past was that, you know, the venues were only used once, twice, maybe three times a year, as opposed to where, you know, you can look at a basketball arena is used for 41 home games and then additional concerts and things like that. An NFL stadium's used for, you know, eight home games, two exhibition home games, and then other events like that. So, you know, and while the crowds have been larger than in some years and past years at track than maybe some of these overall events, the idea of, you know, 41 plus events in an arena versus, you know, two or three at a track, it's like, well, where are you going to put your money at if you're going to have a certain amount of money? Now, you certainly have, this is a rarity to some degree, but you have seen this in the past. Now, in 2013, the Indiana governor signed a bill into law that gave the Indiana Finance Authority the power to issue bonds to raise $100 million for upgrades at Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And among some of the safeguards of that is the track must make a $2 million annual investment through the life of the bonds. But, yeah, there haven't been too many times where, you know, governments have given some public money to tracks. And I think, you know, to some degree, you might see that change a little bit more as tracks do more and more things at their facility to attract people and to bring them into the community in that area.
I think the average person hears Indiana and they might say, oh, all right, that makes more sense to me because I associate one major part of auto racing with Indiana. Phoenix, maybe not so much. Am I missing the point there?
No, I mean, I think Indiana is a unique situation. I think that's why it came out before you've seen some of these other places. And I think this is interesting with Arizona because it is something different and it is a different way of doing it. Obviously, what this is a sign, I think, of big changes coming to Phoenix International Raceway. That track is owned by International Speedway Corporation. And now that's the same group that invested, that did a $400 million renovation over a couple of years at Daytona International Speedway. And Lisa France Kennedy, the chief executive officer at IFC, said this year after they got done with the Daytona project that among the two tracks they were looking at next to make upgrades were Phoenix International Raceway and Richmond International Raceway in Richmond, Virginia.
See, that's interesting because, again, Daytona is another place that's really identified with auto racing. So does that mean that Phoenix is really starting to come into play here as a major player when it comes to auto racing?
Well, in one sense, Phoenix is an important track to NASCAR because it hosts the next to last race of the season. And it's the final event to qualify for the championship race at Homestead Miami Speedway. And so there's a lot of emphasis put on that track. Now, certainly there are some great things at the facility at Phoenix International Raceway, and there are certainly elements that can be improved there. And I think ISC understands that and knows that they can make that something that is a shining example of a track, and particularly out west, to cater to those fans out west. So I think it's something that's growing in importance, but I think it's also something that ISC recognizes they need to do more things there, and they've done some things over the years. There's no doubt about that. But this is a way to kind of make it a jewel of the West.
Dustin Long of NBC Sports. We've been talking about potential changes at Phoenix International Raceway. Dustin, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
The Environmental Protection Agency issued a ruling this week requiring two coal-fired power plants in Utah to install new pollution controls. The state of Utah had proposed a different plan to reduce haze from the plants, but that plan did not include retrofitting the plants with new controls. Monica Morales is with the EPA.
So we put a federal plan in place to replace that part of Utah's plan that we disapproved. And what we put in place are what we call best available retrofit technologies. And these will reduce nitrogen oxide emissions by almost 10,000 tons per year.
The EPA estimates the price tag for the overhaul is around $430 million. But Rocky Mountain Power, the company that owns both plants, estimates the cost will be closer to $700 million. The Salt Lake Tribune reports the company is weighing its legal options, but some Arizona businesses are celebrating the decision because the haze from the plants crosses state boundaries and affects Arizona air. Heather Paris is the owner of self-propelled tours Sedona, a bike tour company.
Air quality can make a huge difference for my business. It's not good to be breathing in pollution when you're cycling, especially if you're cycling hard. And then as well, the views, you know, it certainly impinges on our beautiful scenery.
Paris says for outdoor tour companies, air quality is a constant worry. While she's happy about the EPA ruling, she says a bigger concern right now is three lightning-caused fires currently burning in the area. She says the smoke is settling in the Verde Valley and affecting tours today.
Arizona Congressman Raul Grijalva has introduced legislation that would require federal surveys to collect data on sexual orientation and gender identity. The aim of the LGBT Data Inclusion Act is to make it more likely that people in the LGBT community get counted and their concerns are taken into account. Kellen Baker is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He focuses on LGBT issues. Kellen, why does this legislation make sense?
We're all very aware as advocates and community members that you really can't manage what you can't measure. So we at the community level know that there are a lot of issues, a lot of concerns that LGBT people are facing in their daily lives. And we're aware that we need to have information about what exactly those problems and concerns are if we expect there to be an effective response on a policy level. So in order to really effectively get at all of the issues that LGBT people and families and communities are facing across the country, we really need to know more about who LGBT people are, where we live, and what our struggles and concerns are.
And at its basic level, what sort of data are we talking about?
The sort of baseline is just demographic data, so descriptive data about the aspects of who LGBT people are as LGBT people, so sexual orientation and gender identity. And it's important to know that everyone has a sexual orientation and everyone has a gender identity. So that's not to say that these are questions that should only be asked of LGBT people. It's just that these are the questions where we see the differences between who LGBT people are and who non-LGBT people are. So that's really the basic sort of fundamental level is demographic data about sexual orientation and gender identity. And then there are a variety of other pieces of information that are also really relevant to the lives and experiences of LGBT people. Marital status, for example, that's describing your relationship, which as we know is very intimately related to your sexual orientation. And for many transgender individuals, the correct name and gender pronoun that they use, which may be different from what's on some forms of legal ID, such as a birth certificate.
Would there be any worries about, at least initially, an increase in discrimination?
I think there really is a perception that if more data is collected about LGBT people, that will translate into more discrimination. But I think what we actually see is that people who want to discriminate against LGBT people aren't waiting for a question to be asked or a box to be checked. Discrimination is happening everywhere. It is rife. It is very much a concern for LGBT people in all areas of our daily lives. So actually, I think that visibility really works in the other direction. We've seen that as more people become aware that gay people live next door to them, are in their families, are in their workplaces, are in their schools, we've seen increasing public support for non-discrimination protections for LGB people. And the same is now happening with transgender people. There is definitely a lot of sort of growing pains, I would say, that are happening right now around the country as more people grapple with the reality of transgender people's existence. But as more people come to know that a transgender individual could be your parent, could be your child, could be in your workplace, could be in your school, that they will actually begin to recognize the ways in which LGBT people are not different.
Kellen Baker, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. But there are other questions to be asked, some more focused on anthropology. For that, I'm joined by Madeline Adelman, associate professor in the School of Social Transformation at ASU. She's also a board member of the local chapter of the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network, or GLSEN. Madeline, what makes Representative Grijalva's proposal potentially significant for the LGBT community?
LGBT people can be counted, and I think that means to be included, to be considered. You know, it may sound a little bit funny, but to be counted sometimes actually requires actual counting to mean something in the world, to be accounted for, may require this kind of data collection.
Madeline, if someone from the LGBT community were to say to you, well, the concept is fine, but should privacy play a part in this?
Well, you know, actually within the act, it's a very brief act, anyone can go read it if they wish to, they actually have privacy and confidentiality built into the bill. Now, what that is important for is exactly to protect people from the residual stigma that we experience because of anti-LGBT bias and violence in our world, and we still lack legal protection against discrimination, say in housing or at work or in public accommodation. So privacy and confidentiality does remain paramount. And as anyone else, I fill out forms all the time, and sometimes I wonder, why are they asking me that information? So people will have the choice whether or not they want to complete the form.
In what ways could the data be used? Are there specific needs that you think of that could help the LGBT community that are simply people are not aware of now or that are actually seen as negatives now that could be positives with more data?
My background is in part based on my research on domestic violence. And until domestic violence crimes were coded as domestic violence, it was very difficult to estimate or track the rate, the frequency of domestic violence in this country. So tagging information with demographic information, whether it's the gender of household members, whether it's the sexual orientation of people who are veterans, those kinds of tags can be very helpful in understanding both the contributions of a population, but also their needs. So it could be victimization surveys. It's important to know who is being victimized in our society so that we can address their needs, whether they're common or unique. I do want to say that sometimes we literally need to prove that we exist. So in some of the work that I've done in the Arizona area, we've gotten commentary from parents or teachers or school administrators, and they've made claims like, you know, there are no gay students here or there are no transgender students here. And until we have data to demonstrate, in fact, yes, you have them in your school, in your district, in your county, it can be difficult to provide the interventions that we know that those students deserve.
Do you think it would make sense from an anthropological point of view or a social point of view, whatever it may be, for sexual orientation of all kinds to be included, whether it's heterosexual or lesbian or gay or whatnot?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's funny. Whenever I do trainings or when I'm teaching in a class, I point my finger at everyone and I say, everyone here has a sexual orientation. Everyone here has a gender identity. Now, what that is and who you choose to share it with is really up to you, and it could change over time. And in fact, you know, as an anthropologist, it's interesting to me to see how those categories have changed over time and how they vary by region or generation, race, ethnicity, or even gender.
ASU Associate Professor Madeline Adelman. She's also a board member of the local chapter of the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network, or GLSEN.
What business do marine mammals have living in human captivity, let alone the Sonoran Desert? None, say those protesting a live dolphin exhibit being built in Scottsdale. But as KJZZ's Lauren Loftus reports, officials with Dolphinaris insist their animals will thrive.
In this swath of desert just off the Loop 101 in North Scottsdale, you might expect to hear the cackle of desert birds, the buzz of insects, maybe even the howl of a coyote over the rumble of passing cars. But this? It's a distinct possibility come late summer. Concrete is already being poured at the future site of Dolphinaris, which will house 8 to 12 dolphins born in captivity. It will allow visitors to see, touch, and even swim with the animals. Some are furious about the new residents, saying cetaceans, which include dolphin and whales, are definitely not one of Arizona's five C's and don't belong here. But General Manager Dr. Gray Stafford says there are a lot of what he calls false narratives about the toll human interaction takes on dolphins.
You have animals typically living longer in zoos and aquariums than they do in the wild. And you also have animals nowadays that are trained to participate in their own care through voluntary blood draws, through daily weighing.
Stafford has spent 25 years working in zoos and aquariums, most recently at Wildlife World Zoo in the West Valley. He points to a 2014 Associated Press analysis. It looked at the Federal Marine Mammal Inventory report, which showed animals in captivity live as long or longer than those in the wild. Stafford also says federal licensing requires dolphinaires to educate the public about the species in their care.
Trainers will be building a rapport with the guests, answering questions, providing scientific and conservation messages.
But critics say there isn't any educational benefit to these encounters, since captive dolphins don't give a whole lot of insight into their wild cousins. Dr. Madalena Bayarzi is the president of the Ocean Conservation Society in Los Angeles.
They are nothing like the animals they observe in the wild. They don't behave the same. Socially, they're not the same. They don't have a social life. They are psychologically messed up.
In this Nova PBS documentary on the private lives of dolphins, scientists show how the highly intelligent creatures use their distinct clicks and whistles to interact with each other.
They may use them like names to keep track of each other in a murky underwater world.
Then there's the issue of simply getting them here. Bayarzi says transferring them from one facility to another actually tears up dolphin social structures. Plus,
you have to take them out of the water. That's not their environment.
Within the U.S., dolphin transfers are regulated by NOAA, or the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Facilities have to submit notice to NOAA before the planned transport. Once the animals arrive, the facility needs to be licensed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture to open the exhibit to the public. Tanya Espinosa with the USDA says facilities have to meet certain standards set by the 1966 Animal Welfare Act.
We look to make sure the animals have adequate housing, so their enclosure sizes, are they the appropriate sizes for that particular animal? We also look at their sanitation.
A facility has three tries within a 90-day period to pass a scheduled pre-license inspection and meet every standard. If it doesn't pass, it has to wait 6 months to reapply. Meanwhile, Espinosa says animals can stay in their new home, they just can't be exhibited.
It's up to each state as to whether or not somebody can own those animals.
But in the case of Dolphinaris, it's not up to Arizona at all, since the facility isn't on state land. It's being built on the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community. So neither Arizona Game and Fish nor the State Department of Agriculture has any oversight on the reservation. The area around it includes the Odyssey Aquarium, Butterfly Wonderland, a baseball stadium, and a casino. Some opponents argue its location proves Dolphinaris is more about human enjoyment than animal conservation. Courtney Vale with the Whale and Dolphin Conservation Charity uses the example of the dolphins living at the Mirage Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas to show how these animals have no business living in the desert.
They suffer from respiratory problems. They suffer from skin conditions that are a byproduct of stress. There are injuries to the dolphins that participate in interactive programs.
Despite opposition efforts to block the exhibit, Dr. Stafford says he plans for dolphins to arrive here in the next few months and Dolphinaris to open to the public in September. Lauren Loftus, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Steph Curry.
Yeah, maybe in your dream, Steve. He's Steve Goldstein. With the Takeaways, John Hockenberry. I'm Mark Brody.
Basketball is about dunks and fast breaks. It's also about lock in. 5.4 million people receive that message before every Golden State Warriors game from Stephen Curry 30. Yes, I mean that Stephen Curry 30. And they received that message last night. The tweet handle of Curry is just one bit of Twitter theater. Groundbreaking night for the Warriors, says the NBA Twitter account, which also delivers the screen candy of a Vine video of Steph Curry taking out a Cavaliers guard, animation of the ground breaking like an earthquake underneath him, and then Steph makes a three-pointer. That's a lot more fun to watch than the monosyllabic utterings of players.
Just got to keep playing and remain calm and go forward from there.
They're a very battle-tested team, showed a lot of perseverance.
Continue this journey.
And everything's on the line.
On social media, 66 million people got pinged, poked, or received notifications during Game 1 of the NBA Finals. Oh, by the way, the Golden State Warriors beat the Cleveland Cavaliers. You probably knew this. One detail, here's another. The NBA is the third largest American professional sports league in terms of revenue behind the NFL and Major League Baseball, but it has twice as many followers as the NFL. Baseball has 15 million followers, the NHL has just 11 million. Basketball's social presence is international. This winter, the league claimed that it had over 1 billion followers across league, team, and player accounts in the U.S. and China. It's like basketball is some kind of social media platform all by itself. Fans, players, and sponsors trying to reach each other with tweet, after Vine, after Vine. Jason Concepcion is a tweetmeister. 103,000 Twitter followers he has. He's an NBA superfan and a writer for the new sports and culture site, The Ringer. Jason, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What would you be without Twitter?
I'm not sure. Let's not explore it too deeply.
No, but the combination of the NBA, fandom,
yes,
and Twitter,
yeah,
is something new to the world.
Sure. I think something about the culture of the game lends itself to this kind of trash-talking, personality-driven medium that social media obviously is.
You can't hit a mid-court three-pointer, right?
Me personally?
Yeah.
Since no one's seeing this, yes, I can. Sure.
No, you can't, Jason. But you can tweet just like LeBron.
Yes. Sure.
Or anyone else.
Yeah, I think the fact that Twitter is this kind of leveling force, it gives people the ability to be courtside, to comment directly on the game, to talk directly to the players, is a powerful force. Beyond sports, but obviously in the NBA as well.
It's like you're Spike Lee courtside at the Knicks game. It's like you're on the court being able to yell something in the middle of a game because it's that fast-paced.
Yes. I mean, that's what I was going for when I first started tweeting at basketball games, was to just try and capture that vibe when you're at the park or you're in a small high school gym and people are just talking to the players. You can hear the players speak to each other and capture that vibe.
When have you nailed it? Give me a couple of points where you've nailed it in the course of a season.
The very first tweet that I thought, oh, that one was pretty good, was during the 2009-ish playoffs. The running joke at the time was that Doug Collins, a commentator, was very fond of LeBron, perhaps overly so.
Right.
So I made a joke in that vein. I think that was the first time that I thought, oh, you know, like, okay, this is how you kind of use this.
Who are some of your favorite tweeters in the NBA space? And they don't have to be players. They could be players and fans.
Oh, man. I would say Zach Lowe, I think, is great if you want really smart commentary. Nate Duncan is another guy if you really want that intelligent commentary. Shea Serrano is a hilarious person who is a writer. I would promote The Ringer and say, like, people that are affiliated with the NBA at The Ringer are great follows. Let's see. Matthew Dellavedova, it's like quietly a very good social media presence, not necessarily on Twitter, but otherwise. Tristan Thompson also.
What about stars trying to intimidate their opponents using Twitter and then maybe carrying it out on the
That's part of what makes the medium really great is it gives you entree into these kind of things that you wouldn't hear unless you're sitting courtside. I think one of my favorite things that ever happened on Twitter was Dion Waiters, who now plays for the Oklahoma City Thunder, was at the time playing for the Cleveland Cavaliers. He was getting a lot of criticism about his style of play, and he tweeted a highlight reel of himself from like a season previous, and he said, you know, men lie, buckets don't. But DNT, all caps, is just one of the great moments of social media.
What makes the NBA more sort of digitally savvy than the rest of the world?
Well, I think it skews younger, for one. That mm-hmm. certainly helps. So there's a lot of digital natives there. The NBA has always been more personality-driven than the other sports by the simple fact that there's less players on the court and more chance for an individual player to affect the outcome of a game. The NBA has always marketed itself that way as a star-driven league. It's just fun to play with the image of stars. And obviously the players are using social media as a way to increase their brand.
It's as though visually the game lends itself it to does. Quick videos, quick, you know, vines, these sorts of things. And the other sports don't. I mean, they're just too slow.
Well, it's a fast free. It certainly is a faster, more free flowing sport. Not as free flowing as soccer, obviously. But you know, you've got it's end to end. You've got one on one interactions all over the court. And unlike football, where you've got lots of one on one interactions, you can see them because there's less players on the court. Baseball is obviously a lot of stop starts, and this is part of what the NBA is trying to leverage with in terms of increasing their global popularity. You know, this flowing, freestyling sort of game.
Does social media predict this series? Is there a way of saying in the social media world, the Warriors or the Warriors fans or the Cavaliers fans are expressing themselves better or worse?
Well, I think, listen, the Warriors are one of the most electric bandwagon teams of recent memory. They play an attractive style. Furthermore, the narrative around the club is one of this kind of Silicon Valley disruption. They take more threes than anyone. You know, Steph Curry is changing the game. They're changing the game in the way they play. Small ball has revolutionized the game. So there's this, when you get on that bandwagon, you get that feeling of, hey, you know, that kind of Silicon Valley utopianism. I'm changing the world. I'm improving basketball by liking this team. If they play the way they've played for most of the season, I think they win the series probably in 5 or 6.
LeBron personally has used social media very successfully, but he's no match for the Warriors' footprint at this point.
Yeah, the Warriors are a global team at this point. There's people that didn't like basketball before that love the Warriors.
So you could go to the middle of Mongolia.
People love Steph Curry. Something I've never seen before, which is player warm-ups. You've got fans and kids swarming Steph Curry's player warm-ups as he does a kind of two-handed dribbling routine, then he takes shots from the tunnel, the player exit tunnel, and people tweet these things and go and watch this. This is something people have not seen before because he really is, the way he plays evokes this kind of childlike joy that translates across nations.
Jason Concepcion, writer for The Ringer, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.